Now, the new 940 Montreal presents The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman.
Well, there's certainly enough in local news today and provincial news to make anybody angry. The story of baby Raphael, even though seemingly resolved by the end of the day, brings up the whole question of how much information we all have to know just to stay alive in this world. And with a health bureaucracy that we have, is it getting any better? Are amalgamations making anything better? Is information being more accessible? It's maddening. I don't think there's anybody out there who hasn't gone through some family emergency with the medical system. And we want to hear from you about your experiences. We'll be talking with Dr. Paul Saba, president and founder of the Physicians Coalition for Social Justice. We're going to be also looking at this remarkable number, which has to be parsed, of $167 million spent for public service sector employees for sick days that averaged 14 and a half sick days per employee plus their vacations. The reason we're going to look at it is not just from the standpoint of why are we paying for it and what a burden it is, but from the standpoint that Quebec is a political jurisdiction, one-fifth the population of California, twice the number of bureaucrats. The problem is obvious. We're creating programs we don't need, staffing them with horrendous amounts of bureaucracy, and in many cases forcing that bureaucracy, those bureaucrats, into public service sector unions that make it almost impossible to resist the lure of the ins and outs of their collective agreements that allow for this much time off on the public's back. But we want to start the show tonight with a national issue, and it's going to become important with the nuclear test in Korea. We're a country that's become addicted to polls for better or worse, and you've got to be very careful in choosing a pollster, kind of like choosing a doctor. And we're going to get polls pretty soon on what Canadians think about North Korea, just as we've been inundated with polls about Afghanistan. And General Lewis McKenzie had a piece today in the Globe and Mail that we really should keep in mind. And the point he was making was that the questions that are asked in foreign policy polling are the wrong questions. The example he gave is that a response comes in with 50-plus percent saying no when Canadians are asked, do you support Canadian troops serving in Afghanistan? He then goes on, however, to point out that the professional polling firm should be prepared to ask the following questions that are perhaps as relevant, such as, do you support letting the Taliban return to power in Afghanistan? Do you support beheading teachers in front of their class if they permit even one girl to attend? Do you support denying all Afghan women the right to visit a doctor? The numbers change. And we're very pleased to begin our show tonight with Dr. Conrad Wynn, president of Compass Polling, who's made this point over and over and over and again and debunked other polls by going to the next question, by broadening the field. Conrad Wynn, thanks for taking time to be with us tonight. I know you're in a press schedule.
Well, thank you for having me.
Conrad, I guess, first of all, we should start off by asking, I guess it's inevitable that we're going to start having polling on Canada's reaction to North Korea, Canada's relationship with China, number one. And number two, Lewis McKenzie seems to be thinking just the way you are as to the context of the polls and the breadth of the polls.
No, I thought his piece was excellent. He asked a whole bunch of other questions. You know, if you withdraw from Afghanistan, do you want the Taliban to take over? Do you want the Taliban to forbid women and girls to get any kind of education? Do you want a public execution of a woman is accidentally seen in the presence of a man who's not her husband or her father? That kind of thing. So I thought it was an excellent piece. But you know, there's so many. Kind of absentee fathers to this problem child of poor polling. You know, one of them is the media. Another is the public. I mean, let's face it, we're part of the problem, we people in the public, because we want our news for free. We pay very little for newspapers, and fewer of us are actually buying newspapers. 50 years ago, the average household subscribed to more than one paper. Today, the average household doesn't even subscribe to one paper. So, I mean, that's part of the problem. They just don't have the revenue. And so, for newspapers, the only good poll is a free poll.
Conrad, hold that thought. We've got to pay a bill here before we get outpolled, and we'll be right back with you.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. It's the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
We're starting out tonight. We're talking with Dr. Conrad Wynn, president of Compass Polling, one of the most thorough and best houses in the country, on the impact of polls and the impact of the public on the polls. Conrad, before the break, you were making the point that the public itself, besides not being asked the right questions and the right breadth of questions, themselves have a problem with understanding the issues because they don't read as much as they used to.
Well, they don't read as much as they used to, and there's a pervasive aversion to news, which is so often bad. So people don't want to read, and quite apart from the news being bad, they're not sure how truthful it is because they don't trust journalists, whom they perceive as having a hidden agenda. And journalists report on politicians, and they don't trust politicians because there's nothing hidden about so many of their lies and misstatements. So there are all these reasons to really turn off the news.
So would people sort of get back at the bad news by getting back at the pollsters and saying all kinds of outrageous things?
No, it's not that they're saying outrageous things. Now, the root problem of media polls, and remember, media polls are the worst polls, period. When businesses buy public opinion research or customer research, especially when it really matters to their market share, they spend a lot of money and they spend a lot of time and they pay a lot of attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of questions being asked. When government spends tax dollars, you know, your dollars and mine, on polls, they don't hesitate to spend a great deal of money because they up to a limit, they need to know the truth, the limit being access to information or freedom of information, and that scares them, and that means that they'll sometimes not ask questions they'd really like to ask for fear it'll embarrass their government.
Right, so a lot of
But the media polls are generally just very poor because they can't afford anything more than very poor.
Now, when you say media polls, these aren't polls generated by media organizations. These are businesses who say...
The media polls are purchased by the media. They're the polls you have on Afghanistan. You know, you start with the Lou McKenzie story.
Right.
They're the polls on foreign policy. So they're polls commissioned by the media. And the media are driven by one main consideration. How can I get something for nothing or close to nothing?
So instead of asking seven questions, which would take a lot more money, they'll ask three.
Yeah, but, you know, seven wouldn't do it. It'd be more like, you know, 57. And it might even be two or three polls if you really want to know where Canadians stood. But the media are not flush with money, certainly not the print media. Some of the broadcasters are. And there's no great pressure to do, you know, really good work. Apart from that, there's a culture in the media that says, we're in the business of we're in a circus business. The newspapers and broadcasters are like the circus. It's the extreme act. It's the midget. It's the giant.
Right.
It's not the normal person who's just learned a lot about ballet who people come to watch. They come to watch the weirdo. So it's the simple question, the extreme answer. The moment you start giving gray answers, they don't like it. Even if they prefer, you know, even if they don't actually like the outcome, because they have their own ideas and ideologies, they still prefer a black and white or clear-cut, simple answer that they don't like to a nuanced answer they might feel more comfortable with because they're in a kind of circus business of extreme headlines.
You as a professional, and one of the best professionals in this business, one of the most thorough ones in this business, do you ever say to a potential client, media, government, or corporate, well, no, if that's how thin you want me to slice it, I'm not going for the headline?
Well, the non-journalist clients don't really want the headline. In business, they just want to know how to improve market share, and sometimes you think they're wrong and you tell them that, and because they're so determined to improve market share or protect share or whatever it is, they have all open ears and it's an honest discussion. If you're dealing with government, it can be an honest discussion up to a point. Because of access to information, there are questions that that they can't afford to ask. I mean, you, one of your pet interests is opening up medical freedom, medical choice, and governments, when they commission surveys, have tended not to permit those the kinds of questions that would reveal how open Canadians are to medical choice because they don't want to embarrass their government. So that's a limit. But with journalists, not all journalists, some are the exception, but most of them are very budget constrained. And if they overspend, they lose their job. They're in the business of maximizing headlines per dollar.
One of my pet peeves, however, is our foreign policy polls, because frankly, most people couldn't find some of these countries on the map. Sadly, of course, we see the images of bodies coming back, and based on that, companies are polling on foreign policy issues. Mm-hmm. Should any attention be paid on foreign policy polls?
Well, I think you have to pay attention to all polls, but you have to put them in context. And in one of the contexts you always have to keep in mind is whether or not this would affect their vote. So you could have 80% saying pull troops out of Afghanistan, and very few of this 80% changing their vote accordingly, because they don't want to be there, but they also don't want to bother learning where Afghanistan is or what it's about, and they defer to their leaders, the party leaders, and they'll make a judgment about which party to vote for based on something other than whether we're in Afghanistan. The public is driven in part by a desire to be efficient. Don't make me learn too much because I've got diapers to change and dishes to watch and golf to play.
You're saying very elegantly what I'm about to say. They're getting dumb and dumber.
Well, I'm not sure they're getting dumber, but there's an efficiency preoccupation. You know, why should I study this? Who's going to pay attention to my views anyhow? But they're pretty good at judging whether a political leader is sane or insane or not quite genuine, that kind of thing, and that's the basis for their overall choice. You can't fool them repeatedly. Look at the last election. The Liberals tried to run a second election campaign based on fear that Harper is going to eat their firstborn for Easter and their secondborn for Christmas, and it just backfired.
Beautifully put. Conrad Wynn, many, many thanks for being with us tonight. President of Compass Polling.
Thank
Have a good evening. Montreal will be right back.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. You're listening to the new 940 Montreal. Now, back to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman. Call Beryl at 790-0006.
And we want to hear from you tonight about the two things that were in the news all day and that should really make you very angry. One is the story of the baby Raphael story, which was being resolved by the end of the day. But the amount of stuff that we've got to know just to get through the health system is just unbelievable. And we want to hear your stories. In the baby Raphael story, it came out that the hospital, according to the health minister, didn't know about certain programs. And we've all lived this hell to one degree or another. And we want to hear from you. The other story today that's tied into this a bit is the remarkable numbers that were thrown around this morning of $167 million, taxpayer dollars, that were spent on public service sector employees who had sick days averaging 14 and a half each. That, of course, combined with their usual vacations, would lead to 4 or 5 weeks off for most of our public sector workers. Now, the problem in Quebec is that we're a population one-fifth the size of California with twice the number of bureaucrats. And most of those bureaucrats forced into public sector service unions that have very, very generous packages. What's the solution? And with us to discuss it is from Vancouver is John Mortimer, founder and president of Labor Watch. And you could, fascinating site, laborwatch.com. John Mortimer, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good to be here. How are you?
Okay. We obviously can't blame people for getting sick if they're really sick, but the number of $167 million is a staggering number, and my take on it is, we've got so many programs in Quebec that we don't need. We've got such a nanny state out here, and I'm not sure that British Columbia is so far behind. Add to that, every nanny state program needs more bureaucrats, and add to that the fact that they've got to be in unions with very generous agreements, and you've got the makings of trouble, don't you?
Well, and there's a deeper issue. If you were to talk to benefits experts who administer large benefit plans in this country, if you were to talk to people who pay attention to short-term disability leaves, long-term disability leaves, workers' compensation claims,
right,
the anecdotal perspective is that the days lost is higher in unionized environments than in non-union environments. And I think that that's actually a subject that's worthy of fairly serious inquiry, particularly taxpayers who should be very concerned about how their tax dollars are spent, because at the end of the day, they have very little control other than voting one, you know, proponent of big government out and replacing them with another.
Right.
We really don't have anyone who's advocating truly smaller government, true competition, getting government out of our lives and only having it involved in the areas where it's needed. So I think that one of the big untold stories is 75% unionization in the public sector in general, higher in Quebec, whereas it's generally in the teens in the private sector.
John Mortimer, please stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
We want to hear from you about two stories today that should make you furious. The baby Raphael story. And the point about that is the hospitals can't even figure out the bureaucracies anymore. So let's hear about your horror stories. And right now we're talking to John Mortimer of Labor Watch about this extraordinary $167 million that the Quebec taxpayers were paid out last year for an average of 14 and a half sick days for public sector service employees. It's not that people don't have a right to be sick. It's the fact that we have such a bloated bureaucracy in Quebec with so many nanny state programs that we don't need, twice the number of bureaucrats as the state of California, and all control is being lost. Now, John, you were making the point before the break that it's not just a matter of the bureaucracy, it's even a matter of what rights the workers have within the bureaucracy. Is there a relevance to unions in the public sector, given the job security and all the other perks they have, which were not necessarily won by unions? The perks in the public sector were there from the days of the bad old, Huey Long era.
Huey Long. Well, I think the interesting thing would be if we were to eliminate forced dues, like most other progressive countries in the world have done, including, I think, all of Europe, if we were to end forced membership, which doesn't exist in every part of the union world in this country, but in many of them it does, and we would actually let unionized employees choose whether to pay dues or not, choose whether to be members or not, and then in 10 years, Beryl, let's see how many of them are actually members and are actually paying dues or want to have a different attitude towards work and have a different attitude than their union leaders claim that their members have.
Would you apply this to all sectors? In other words, there are certain industrial sectors where unions are really necessary for the protection of workers, but the public service isn't one of them. Is there not an argument to be made that, public service, when you cut it down, we'll talk. And what are you doing? What is a union doing there in any case?
Well, I think in some cases, unions may be about protecting workers, but I think if you look at a much more progressive union like CLAC, which is a growing union, which wants to be about ensuring employee involvement in the workplace to ensure excellence of products and excellence of services, versus more traditional mainline unions that are saying management bad, union good, love us,
right,
listen to us, don't listen to them. I mean, if you look at what unions do with their members' money and how anti-employer and anti-management they often are, and I think that they do that largely to, you know, try to keep a hold over people. It's a repetitive routine they can't get themselves out of. And I think they also, frankly, in some cases, they encourage employee abuse of programs. You look at the things that unions grieve, the theft that they'll grieve, the violation of policies that they will grieve, and the decisions that arbitrators make and the stuff that they allow unionized employees to get away with is not good, I think, for the attitude of work, for the attitude towards excellence, and cannot be good in this country for the level of service and productivity we get out of our civil servants.
You know, we've got an interesting statistic in Quebec that the industrial unions, and this is really the reason I asked the question, last year in Quebec, the industrial unions had the least number of days lost to strikes in Canada, believe it or not, or less than Ontario, the main unionized jurisdictions, whereas the public service sector unions had the most days lost to strikes. Now, I know one of Labor Watch's main mandates is... it's about freedom, first of all. You want to be unionized, you want the workers to be able to get the information that they have. If a worker doesn't want to be unionized, you want them to have the right to be for that freedom as well. How does that work? How would that work in a government setting?
Well, I think it could only begin if we go back to what I said before and what's taken place in other countries. You know, the European Court of Human Rights, I think it was in 1993, banned forced union membership. Okay?
Right.
So they truly gave people a freedom of conscience, a freedom of opinion, and a freedom of association. Canada is one of the last countries in the world that has that. I think that there's plenty of people inside of government, particularly who are teachers, who don't believe in the union party line,
right.
Don't want to be a part of it. But, I have a friend who's a teacher out here in British California, as I affectionately refer to the West Coast.
That's just because you guys are so laid back there.
Yeah. And you know what? During the illegal strike, he feared the intimidation of his fellow union members who believed in breaking the law to make a point. And so here's a guy, a father of two kids, who went out and broke the law and went on strike because he didn't want to have stuff happen to his home. He didn't want to be ostracized around the workplace. And I'm sorry to the union leaders out there, okay? You know it's true. You encourage your union members to ostracize other people who don't toe the party line. You know, sometimes I think, Beryl, that the pressure against a union member is far greater than some of the worst management cases in terms of how people are treated.
It's getting rough. John Mortimer, LaborWatch.com. That's LaborWatch, OUR.com. John, thanks.
And for your French-speaking audience, infotravail.ca.
Infotravail.ca. Merci beaucoup, John Mortimer.
Take care.
Take care. Andy, how you doing? Andy?
Oh, hello there.
How are you?
Not too bad. Last night I tried to get on, but you were fully...
It was crazy last night. Andy, we're in our new studio, so we can't talk to our... phone lines. So we're... as a matter of fact, I'm going to ask you to just hold your thought for 2 seconds. We're going to pay a bill and we'll be right back.
Okay, no problem.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. You're listening to the new 940 Montreal. Now, back to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman. Call Beryl at 790-0006.
There's enough to be angry about today with the waste of money on public service sector employees, sick days, and the maddening case of baby Raphael, and what that points out about the hospital system, and we'll be getting to that with just a great man, Dr. Paul Saab, in just a minute. Right now, Andy. Thanks for your patience.
Oh, I'm always patient. Thing is, before I go on with the unions and the public service, may I make a comment on yesterday?
Sure.
Yesterday, you know, the way the world is now, the people will be crying for the old Iron Curtain system, the superpowers, because we were at ease, because they both knew that if something goes wrong, the world will disappear. But now, without these
yep,
two...
Yep, it was called mutually assured destruction, the mad theory, and you're quite right. Right now we got got a lot of dirty bombs in a lot of little places.
And these people don't really care. And this could have a chain effect, a relay effect. And by the way, North Korea having the bomb, nobody's going to sanction them. And I'll tell you why. Because Russia, China is actually glad about it. Because it affects the Western community in much ways. And they actually, what they say at the United Nations Security Council, that's a lot of bull. That's for the public consumption. But in reality, they are overjoyed. Now, getting to the union. The labor contracts should be written on one page. But
I wish any contract could be written on one page.
It can be. Thing is this, you leave out all the extras, you leave all the stupidity out, but it can only be done if the so-called public servants, which is the premier and all those lackeys, take a first step, cutting out the extras. Make it simple so that there would be no lawyers getting involved in no court cases. Maximum 3 days for the public servant sick leave, and that's it.
Andy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've talked a lot on this show about courage and conscience. And we try to teach communities and we try to teach citizens that in our work at the Institute of taking responsibility for your life. Don't depend on the government to solve all problems. And I'm, as always, proud and privileged to be joined by Dr. Paul Saba, Chair and President of the Coalition of Physicians for Social Justice. They put themselves on the line, and Paul Saba is one of the most eloquent voices for what we need to do, and what we need to do is stand up for ourselves. Paul, thank you for taking time out for a busy schedule tonight.
Thank you, Beryl.
This baby Raphael case, supposedly toward the end of the day, Health Minister Couillard said, well, it was the Royal Victoria Hospital that didn't know that this emergency monetary fund was available so the baby could go home. But this begs the question. And as I said earlier in our introduction, I've lived it. I can't imagine anybody who hasn't lived through in some area of a massive health bureaucracy. The amount of stuff that civilians, citizens need to know is enormous just to stay alive. But the amount of stuff that even healthcare professionals need to know with this burgeoning bureaucracy that doesn't seem to be getting simpler or more streamlined is frightening.
Yeah,
where are we going with this?
And, you know, even the health care reforms that were put in place by this government have actually increased the number of administrators, has increased the number of bureaucrats. For example, our hospital, like many hospitals, has been merged with another hospital. Lachine has been merged with LaSalle. What they have done is they suddenly say, oh, my, we need now to have, instead of one administrator at each place for a particular service, it might be radiology, it might be laboratory services, or it might be some other service, we need to have one person to coordinate these two other services. So now they've hired a third person, so they've increased the bureaucracy from 2 to 3, so you've got a 50% increase. At the same time, they say, oh, now we have twice as many beds, so it's the same number of beds, but because the two have been merged,
right.
Instead of having, let's say, 100 beds in each hospital, they now say, well, we have a hospital with 200 beds. Well, 100 plus 100 is 200. That's normal mathematics. But they say, oh, we can't have 200 beds. We must only have 100. So we're going to eliminate 100 beds. So what they do is they try to save money by reducing health care services, but they, on the other hand, they increase the number of administrators who oversees this reduction in health care services. So they're saving money. They're not actually saving money. They're increasing the cost because of more bureaucracy, but they're reducing the services to the patients.
And the point of increased the point of increasing the number of people is what, according to them?
Well,
the,
you know, they say it's cost efficiency because they figure, well, it costs less to hire an administrator than to hire doctors who will care for patients, and then they have to have less health care costs. So they save a little bit in terms of health care, but they haven't really saved that
but
much.
But wait a minute. Was not the whole thinking behind the super hospitals predicated on the fact that they could cut their beds by doing a lot more outpatient treatment? Because they'd be buying the state-of-the-art equipment. How do you do outpatient treatment without doctors? Who needs administrators and bureaucrats?
Well, what they forget is that we have an aging population, and as you get older, people take a longer time to recuperate. The human organism hasn't evolved to a rapid healing organism. You know, we're not like computers where we have more RAM and more gigabytes and gigahertz and all this. You know, our patients are getting older. They need more care. They need more tender, loving care, and they need more assistance. It takes longer. You know, we have patients with multiple diseases, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and all this takes time to get better, and they don't recover overnight. You know, they're basing their whole approach to health care on the model of the 70s, where in the States they were developing these HMOs. The idea
right.
of the HMOs was you have young, healthy, working population. You have diagnostic and treatment centers, so you get people in and out. You find out that they have a pneumonia, you treat it, and they're in and out.
So you might treat the disease, but you're not treating the person.
That's
Paul,
right.
Paul Saba,
and
hold the thought for one moment.
Right.
We just got to pay some bills. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
You.
Bye.
No.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call the Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
And we're talking with Dr. Paul Saba, chair of the Coalition of Physicians for Social Justice, about the how unwieldy this medical system has gotten out. And as an illustration, this baby Raphael story where hospital administrators don't even know where they're going. Paul, would you bear with us while we take a caller?
Yes, go ahead.
Peter, welcome.
Yes, hi, Beryl. Hi, Mr. Saba. You know, several years ago when the PQ government with Landry's accounting principles decided to buy out the contracts of nurses and doctors, do you know that we are still paying for this till the year 2015? While I see that we are now hiring nurses that are independent from the system, paying them twice the price. I don't know.
Yeah, that was an astounding thing. Paul Saba, was there any merit to this forced retirement and buyout of doctors, and especially as you made the point that we don't have enough people treating an aging population?
Yeah, you know why they did it, Beryl?
Well, yep.
Only because they wanted to show a balanced budget, and they never were able to do it.
Peter, you could stay with us. I want to hear Dr. Saba's take on this.
Yeah,
because a lot of our problems, Paul, seem to have stemmed since then, or is that just my imagination?
No, I think it's a thinking of health as a expense rather than an investment. And they forget to remember that healthy workers help the economy and they continue to work. And even healthy older people continue to live and can produce. And they don't necessarily produce. They often do voluntary work.
Benevole.
Yeah, benevole. But they also are consumers. You know, they pay taxes. They pay their mortgage.
Yeah.
The mortgages are often finished, so they're continually using even healthcare services. So it keeps the economy going. So even from an economic sense, it makes sense to continue to invest in healthcare. But our government looks at healthcare like a model of an expense, kind of like a corporate model, and they're saying, well, we're going to download the expenses off to the private sector, which in the studies have shown that private healthcare costs more people often can't afford. In the States, you have 45 million people without health insurance.
That's without health insurance, but there's over 125 million with substandard insurance that covers 20 to 30% of what they need.
That's right. And, you know, we're looking at, and often the big companies who are pushing for it, I'm not talking about this, small businesses are paying a high tax burden, but we're targeting large, like insurance company and banks. They're pushing for privatizing health care, and they're the ones who have all their head offices down in Barbados and other countries, and they're not even paying taxes. So we're encouraging more and more offloading of the expenses onto the middle class and reducing corporate tax, huge corporate taxes.
And indeed, we've seen that over the past 10 years. The biggest cut in Canada's tax history, except most of it was a shift from the top 3% to the bottom 60%.
That's right. And they keep telling the people, oh, you'll get better health care in the private sector. All they have to look is across the board. And they say, oh, no, well, we'll look to Europe. Well, you know what? We're not in Europe. We're in North America, and we're dealing with a North America environment. You know, they sold us a bill of goods telling us that, closing all of our textile industries and laying people off, workers off, and buying shirts in China was a good idea. And I still pay the same price for the shirt.
It was an unbelievable thing. You know, that's when last year when that happened, when the protectionist walls and textiles fell against China, and the industry minister at the time last year said, well, 40,000 jobs gone in Quebec, but, the textile industry will have to reinvent itself. My God.
That's right. And they tell people you're better off to buy private health insurance. And in the States and New Hampshire, if you were to buy a private policy.
What do you buy it with when you haven't got a job?
$20,000 a year for a young family. $20,000 U.S. for someone who's 40 years old with a wife who's 35 with one child. That's the price of health care insurance. Who has almost $2,000?
Nobody. A friend of mine who's an accountant married a girl in New York, moved down there, gave up his car just to pay for health insurance, which only covers 80% of what they need.
That's right. And in the meantime, we hire more and more bureaucrats, and this government, not only the PQ, the Liberal government also is following in the same pattern as the previous government.
Paul Saba, thank you very much for spending time with us. We've looked at issues tonight that remind me of what Mark Twain used to say about, three kinds of lies, damn lies, and statistics. But he also said, governments use statistics as a drunken man uses lampposts for support rather than illumination. Thanks to everybody out there. Nick Mays in Master Control, Montreal. We'll be back with you tomorrow night.